This is Virginia Insight. I'm Tom Graham. The book is titled Convicting the Innocent, Where Criminal Prosecutions Went Wrong. It's written by a Virginia attorney who spent years poring over trial transcripts and prosecution records of innocent people who were sent to prison for crimes they did not commit. On average, these more than 200 men and a few women spent 13 years behind bars before our court system realized it had made a mistake. What went wrong is just one of the questions the book considers. Others include, if innocent people spend years in prison, shouldn't we be concerned that real culprits were walking free committing more crimes? And if rare DNA evidence proved the system got it wrong, what about all those other cases where there was no DNA? Virginia attorney, author, and legal scholar Brandon Garrett is here to help address those questions and more right after the news. I'm Tom Graham, and this is Virginia Insight. There has been a flaw in my thinking, and I want to tell you about it in case you can identify. In the past, whenever I heard about someone being exonerated after spending years in prison for a crime that it turns out they did not commit, my first thought was, oh, that's terrible. That poor man, how could we have done that to him? How do you ever make up for taking away so many years of an innocent person's life? But now, and in fact, as soon as I began reading Brandon Garrett's book, I realized that while those questions are appropriate, they're far from the only ones that need addressing and may not even be the most important ones. We are coming to you today from the studios of the Virginia Foundation for the Humanities in Charlottesville, but our phone number, the same as always, 888-WMRA-TALK. And if you have questions or thoughts on the topic of wrongful convictions, we do want to hear from you. 888-967-2825. Brandon Garrett, author of Convicting the Innocent, thank you so very much for making time for us.
Oh, thank you for having me.
Well, Brandon, I'm curious, what do you most hope that someone's going to get from reading this book?
Well, I most wanted people to understand that convictions of innocent people don't happen by accident. And in fact, if any of us were sitting on the jury at one of these innocent people's trials, we probably would have convicted them too. And that's what's so haunting about these cases. So I start the book by talking about just one of the 250 first DNA exonerations in this country, the case of Ronald Jones, who was convicted of a horrible murder on the south side of Chicago. And if we were on that jury, I think we would have convicted him, because a friend of the victim saw a homeless guy, looked just like him, accost her in the neighborhood of the murder. And then he confesses in detail, and the detectives describe how he told them everything about the crime scene, where the victim's body was in this abandoned motel. Who would have known about that? Where the blood trail was leading to the window, where the killer escaped, everything. He knew everything about how the murder happened, and they didn't report that stuff to the press. And so the jury was confronted with, okay, sure, maybe this guy is mentally limited. Maybe it was a harsh interrogation. These detectives seem like rough types. But they said they didn't rough him up. And this guy knew all this stuff about the crime that no one else could have known. I think any of us would have convicted him in a heartbeat. And then when we look at this case in retrospect, you know, he tried to get DNA testing once it became available years later. The judge said, what use could that serve? There's no point. You confessed in detail. But eventually he got the DNA, and it showed he was absolutely innocent, that there was someone else, some other man, raped and murdered the victim. And so now all of a sudden the case takes on a completely different cast. And that's what's so unsettling. The case just gets turned upside down. We now know the detectives must have told him the details about the crime. We know that some of the really limited forensics that they had at the time, not DNA, were wrong or misleading. And that was the same story across all of these 250 cases. Cases that looked strong were in fact contaminated. And so it's not the case that we can figure, oh, innocent people get convicted when the evidence is kind of weak and the jury probably should have known it. Maybe they weren't doing their jobs. No, no, no. Here, the jury was absolutely doing its job, and the prosecutor may have been absolutely convinced this guy was guilty, and he was not.
Based on what you're saying, Brandon, I think,
what I would get from that analysis is a sense of hopelessness and despair about our criminal justice system. But that's really not the sense I got from reading your book, because you go further. You talk about ways that the system isn't working and some relatively easy fixes for how these kinds of things, wrongful convictions, could be greatly minimized.
Yeah, so this is actually a hopeful book, and I tell a hopeful story for how we can prevent these cases. And obviously, we start in a pretty dark place when we realize that a case can go so terribly wrong in a way that would be totally disguised from a lot of the people who work hard in our criminal justice system. And so I'm not suggesting that there are these cops and prosecutors and judges out there to frame innocent people. Far from it. But what we have is a system that doesn't document evidence well and doesn't work as accurately as it could. So if there had been just simply a videotape of the entire interrogation of poor Ronald Jones, we would have known that when police were asking him questions, he actually couldn't answer them. He didn't know those details. They had to kind of feed the details to him, most likely. Now, he actually claimed that at his trial. He said, "I'm innocent. They told me what to say," but no one believed him. Now, it could be that those detectives knew that they were lying and were trying to frame him, but they could have absolutely lost track of those facts during a long and complicated interrogation. They really wanted to get the right person. That's how they were motivated. They wanted to crack this case, and they didn't have any record, and so they lost track of who said what. None of us remember very well who says what during everyday conversations. This was a really important conversation. We should be videotaping these conversations. And, you know, throughout these cases, there's eyewitness evidence, forensic evidence, informant evidence, all sorts of different types of evidence that's really important in a serious criminal case. And it just simply wasn't documented or handled very well. And so, you know, we would never let evidence from a crime scene just sort of get treated sloppily and thrown this way and that, not documented, not written down, or at least we wouldn't want that to happen in a serious criminal case. But we do that all the time with human evidence that we figure is somehow more trustworthy, like a confession or an eyewitness. And it's just not that different. No matter what the evidence is, we got to track it. Otherwise, there will be wrongful convictions.
Brandon Garrett is our guest. He is a named professor at the University of Virginia Law School, a longtime specialist in civil rights law, and author of the book Convicting the Innocent. If you want to talk to him here on Virginia Insight, we do have a phone line open for you at 888-WMRA-TALK. Or if you'd rather post a comment or question on our Facebook page, we are listed on Facebook as WMRA's Virginia Insight. The 250 cases that you examined in order to write this book, Brandon Garrett, they date back in terms of the earliest convictions when? Sometime in the early 1970s?
More like the mid to late 1970s.
And the very first exoneration of these 250 was in the late 1980s?
In 1989, the first two people were exonerated by DNA. One was a case in Illinois, and one was a case right here in Virginia, a case of another man who falsely confessed named David Vasquez.
Tell us more about that one.
That was a case where only parts of the interrogation were recorded. But actually, even those selective parts that were recorded indicated that he was someone who really had no idea how the crime happened and had to really be walked through it. The victim had been hanged in her house in Northern Virginia, and the detectives were trying to tell him, you know, what to say, and he just didn't follow it. They were trying to say, how did you kill the victim? She was strangled, and he said, "Okay, I strangled her." And they said, "What with?" And he was saying, "I don't know, you know, my belt." They said, no. He was like, "Well, like a string." And they said, they were trying to get him to say that it was the cords from Venetian blinds. And he had no idea what those were. He was kind of like, "Is that like a string? What exactly are you telling me here?" And the detectives were getting more frustrated, and he was getting more confused. He just didn't know his window treatments very well. And nevertheless, he pleaded guilty because the judge concluded after listening to that tape that, oh, yeah, the confession's coming in. Judges are incredibly reluctant to suppress a confession, even one where it's clear that the person had no idea what they were confessing to and they were being badgered by the police. And he was so mentally limited. And his defense lawyer presumably advised him, look, take the guilty plea. You've confessed. When the jury hears that confession, they're going to give you a long sentence. And maybe the defense lawyer was right, because had it not been for the DNA testing that eventually cleared him, I think everyone would have rested assured that, well, you know, maybe the police told him some things about how this crime happened, but maybe he knew some other things. We think the case is a sound one.
And some of the items that you just described that came up in the police interrogation are only known because that portion of the interrogation was videotaped or was recorded.
Right. It was audio taped.
But the vast majority of the interrogations were not recorded, even in that case, a good portion not recorded. So we don't know everything else that may have slipped.
Yeah, I mean, the best known false conviction in Virginia, perhaps, is the Earl Washington Jr. case just up the road in Culpeper. And years later, one of the detectives in that case candidly admitted to the Attorney General's office in Virginia that, look, actually those key facts about the murder, particularly the stains on a shirt that was found in the victim's bureau drawer, we actually probably told him that. He probably didn't tell us that. And Earl Washington, the case has been written about a fair amount. There's a book about his case, which I recommend. He was a limited guy who would basically say politely, yes, sir, to just about anything he was asked.
And when you say limited, he was mentally limited.
He was borderline mentally retarded, yeah. And he had a coping strategy, which was to smile and agree with people and to try to be agreeable, which is probably a very good coping strategy in general in life, a sweet person. But not a good coping strategy in the interrogation room, where the normal rules of civilized behavior are turned upside down. And the good guys can be bad guys, or the good cops can play bad cop. And he said yes, sir, and agreed when the police that initially arrested him asked him about basically every unsolved rape they can think of, because they had thought he had tried to rape his neighbor. In fact, he just tried to break in to take a gun in a family fight. He absolutely did do that. He ended up shooting his brother in the foot, and they found him in the woods crying. And the police thought that, you know, here's an African-American young guy breaking into a white neighbor's house. It must have been a rape. She said, no, of course not. He wasn't trying to rape me. In those four cases, they knew that they had gotten false confessions. He said, yes, sir, yes, sir, yes, sir, yes, sir. But the victims came forward, other evidence came out. It was very clear he had nothing to do with those rapes. But the police thought that they were on a roll. And this is Fauquier County. They figured, oh, you know, we heard in the news about some big murder in Culpeper County, a rape murder of a young mother. We'll ask him about that, too. And he says, yes, sir. They didn't actually know anything about that crime because it wasn't their case. And Earl Washington was innocent. He didn't know anything either. So there wasn't a lot that they could say to each other. And in fact, when they asked him questions about that crime, since they didn't know, he didn't know, he got everything wrong. He said the victim was black when she was white. He said that she was stabbed a couple of times. She was stabbed 38 times. He got everything wrong. It was only once they brought in the investigators from Culpeper, when he supposedly gave this very uncharacteristically detailed statement where he said that, oh, that shirt that you're showing me, yes, it had bloodstains on it, which he couldn't see because they'd been cut out by that time for forensic analysis, and that shirt was in the rear bureau drawer of the victim's room. And that shirt comes up time and time again in every level of the sort of the Virginia legal and political system. That shirt seals Earl Washington's fate. The Virginia Supreme Court cites to the shirt when they say, sure, his confession was voluntary. He could calmly tell the police about the shirt. Governor Wilder, DNA testing is done in 93, and it clears him. Wilder says, well, I don't know, but he confessed, and he said that stuff about the shirt. So I'm going to give him clemency so he won't be executed, but he's going to serve the rest of his life in prison because of the shirt. Federal courts all said, eventually, relief denied, no habeas corpus for you. You knew about the shirt. Only the killer could have known about that. It took not just that early 1993 DNA test, but only years later when more DNA tests were done and the DNA matched someone else. Only then did the system finally say, okay, 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 the confession was false, he was innocent.
When they finally found the real culprit.
That's what it took in his case, even though we knew for a long time that he was innocent.
So much here about how our criminal justice system has weak points in it and what some of the fixes might be that we have yet to discuss with our guest, legal scholar Brandon Garrett. And you're invited to join the conversation. We'll continue in just a bit more than 1 minute. The book is titled Convicting the Innocent, Where Criminal Prosecutions Go Wrong. Its author, legal scholar Brandon Garrett, is our guest. The book is based on the study of 250 different cases and thousands of pages of trial transcripts documenting prosecutions where someone was convicted of a serious crime, sent to prison for many years, only later to find out that they were innocent and that the person who actually committed the crime had walked free. This is Virginia Insight. I'm Tom Graham. Tell us a little bit about the extent to which we can be confident that in these 250 cases, when DNA testing was finally done, exoneration was absolutely necessary, that there was no question that the person was innocent.
Well, these DNA cases are typically pretty straightforward ones, where there was a sexual assault, and so there was an unknown male person's DNA.
So the vast majority of these cases were rape cases, and some of them rape-murder cases?
Right. A few of them were murder cases where there was some object left at the scene by the perpetrator, the murderer's mask or something like that. But most of these are straightforward sexual assaults. And in over 40% of the cases, the DNA not only excluded the innocent guy, but also matched the culprit, often through a hit in one of the growing set of DNA data banks in this country.
And as you were mentioning before the break, in the Earl Washington case, the Culpepper murder case that's become so well known, it was only once DNA showed that it was someone else who committed the crime and that person confessed that Earl Washington was freed.
Well, the culprit didn't confess. He pleaded guilty years later. Especially in the confession cases, you see that there's such attachment to the idea that an innocent person would never confess, that it takes more than just DNA showing that this guy didn't do it. It takes a DNA hit with someone else. There are even people who were convicted when DNA excluded them at the time of their trials. And the jury convicted. But they had confessed. And it took that DNA hit with someone else to finally free them.
So the obvious question is, why would somebody confess to a crime they did not commit?
Yeah, and in some ways, Earl Washington's case is a more straightforward one where we know that he was mentally limited. He would say yes, sir, when he was asked questions. He would try to get along and might not have appreciated how serious it was to say yes, sir, when you're being asked, did you murder someone? But we might figure, okay, if it's not a juvenile, if it's not someone who's mentally retarded, why would they ever confess to something really serious that they didn't do? But there are plenty of people like that, including in the cases I looked at. And some of those people were actually people maybe more like you and me and our listeners who really do tend to trust our criminal justice system and figure that, if the police ask you questions, you should try to help them and try to solve crimes and cooperate. And they figured at some point that the police were simply not going to let them go. The police were relentless. They'd been interrogated. And it's hard to imagine what it would be like to be interrogated for hours and hours and hours.
Days in some cases.
Almost all these interrogations were more than 3 hours long, which is the limit that police professionals recommend. And after so many hours had gone by, and they've been told, you're not leaving this room unless you tell us what we want to hear, they figured, okay, fine, we'll parrot back this nonsense. But we're innocent. We'll get a lawyer, we'll sort it all out the minute we leave this interrogation room. They had faith in the system, and they believed that truth would prevail, and that this silly nonsense of parroting back what they were told to say would simply go away once they were allowed to leave. But, of course, they were never allowed to leave. They were arrested the minute they provided the confession statement that the police wanted.
Let me see if I can wrap my mind, Brandon Garrett, around these 250 cases that start in the late 1970s in terms of when convictions happen. And then exonerations begin in the late 1980s. Most of them, those exonerations take place in the 1990s. I think of the first 250 cases, which is what your book focuses on, they go up to the early 2000s. So up until around 2003 or so.
The exonerations continued to happen.
But in terms of what you've examined in your book.
The people were originally convicted in cases through the early 2000s, yeah.
And so that's the first 250. And obviously, in the past 10 years, there have been more exonerations since your research was done and your book was published.
Right, right. So the last exoneration that I wrote about for the, in the book happened in early 2010. It was the 250th one. It was a exoneration of a man in New York State named Freddie Peacock. Since then, there have been 50 and change more exonerations. And I'm in the process of updating my data and tracking down records in those cases, too.
One of the things that starts coming up pretty early in this book, Convicting the Innocent, and it's a theme that you return to multiple times, is that in a large percentage of these 250 cases, it was pretty much only luck that there was DNA evidence to be examined after these innocent people had spent years in prison. And that there are lots of other jurisdictions in the country where if the case had taken place, the DNA evidence wouldn't have been available, it wasn't saved.
Absolutely. So one reaction to this might be, oh, there have been over 300 DNA exonerations. Well, we have the biggest mass incarceration state in the world. We have millions of people in prison now and maybe tens of millions from the 1980s through the present. 300 people, that's a tiny drop in an enormous bucket, the biggest bucket in the world. But it looks real different once you realize how difficult it is, what an uphill battle it is to get DNA testing, at least up until the last few years. Now things have tended to change. It's a little bit easier to get DNA now. But now that we can get DNA testing, if a prisoner says, look, I'm innocent, well, usually the evidence is gone and destroyed. You know, the Innocence Project in New York says, you know, more than 75-80% of the time when they try to do DNA testing, the evidence is lost. In Virginia, for example, Virginia is a typical state. The rule was, once a conviction was final, you throw out the evidence. No need to save it. In fact, the only reason additional tests could be done that confirmed Earl Washington's innocence in 2000 was because the hospital where the murdered victim was treated had saved some slides. Just a total accident. Another shocking, shocking, really set of happenstance circumstances, also in Virginia, in part because of Earl Washington's exoneration, a new law was passed that evidence has to be preserved now. But only about half the states have laws like that. And Governor Warner at the time had also learned that there was one analyst at the Virginia Department of Forensic Science, the crime lab that serves all of Virginia, who had happened to save the evidence in cases. Wasn't really following the rules of the lab. You're supposed to destroy the evidence. But she thought it was nice in the courtroom to be able to point in the manila folder that she would bring into the courtroom to be able to point to the swab she tested as a demonstrative to say, show the jury, this is what I tested, and it says the murderer had type A blood, and so does this guy, something like that. And so there are all these folders with evidence, extra copies of the evidence, you know, stapled in them. And Governor Warner said, well, now that we know that some of the evidence wasn't thrown away, let's just pick 30 or so random cases and test them and see what happens. Not people who asked for DNA tests, just 30 random cases. Well, there have been multiple people exonerated out of that initial 30 cases that were just pulled out of a hat. And so then Governor Warner said, okay, well, let's test the rest. And over many years, the crime lab has been pouring through the other cases. Somehow they've only really done testing in a few hundred of the cases, and it's taken a long time. But there have been additional exonerations of people who are in prison. They were convicted. They were innocent. And they gave up. They never asked for a DNA test. Maybe they figured the evidence had been destroyed, which would have been a fair assumption. But these are people who were never proclaiming their innocence. They literally gave up. We have no idea how many people are like that around the country, where the evidence was destroyed or the people gave up and just figured, I'm done for. We just have no idea.
It seems from reading this, Convicting the Innocent, that one of the points, Brandon Garrett, you're trying to make is if we have this fairly small percentage of cases where DNA evidence was saved and eventually the courts allowed it to be examined and these 250 people were found to be innocent, and you look closely at these thousands of pages of court transcripts and what happened in interrogations and see what you see as systemic problems in how prosecutions are being done. You have to come to a conclusion that there are lots of other cases where wrong people were convicted, where DNA right. evidence is not available.
I think you do. Another feature of these cases that just screams out is the number of cases that involved eyewitnesses. Most cases that involve eyewitnesses are not rape cases. You think of all the robberies that happen, where you catch a glimpse of the robber, and the robber runs off. Eyewitness evidence is used in tens and tens and tens of thousands of cases every year. It just so happened in these unusual rape cases, because most rape cases don't involve strangers. In these cases where it was a stranger rapist, you could do DNA testing later. And what I found is that in almost every case, almost without exception, the victim, or sometimes it was a non-victim eyewitness, said, "That's not just the guy, but I am absolutely 100% confident that's the guy. That is the face. I will never forget that face. It's the defendant." And these eyewitnesses were wrong, without exception. Sometimes there are cases where there are multiple eyewitnesses who are all wrong. There's a well-known case of Thomas Hainsworth here in Virginia. He was exonerated just in the last couple of years, where there are multiple eyewitnesses who all made the same mistake. Kirk Bloodsworth, the first exoneree off of death row in Maryland. Maryland recently abolished the death penalty in part in response to his story. Five eyewitnesses were all wrong, and they were all absolutely certain. But it's absolutely predictable that eyewitnesses can make serious mistakes that the jury would never comprehend or have any information about, because we know that when lineups aren't done right, it can change the memory of an eyewitness. And psychologists have been studying this for 30 years now. But somehow that research hasn't affected the way that most police departments do their lineups. And so wrongful convictions are inevitable. And in fact, we know that eyewitnesses make mistakes all the time because they often pick out fillers in lineups. And so we know they've made a mistake. What we don't know is how often they make a mistake that involves not picking the filler, but picking the suspect who then becomes convicted. But you know, most police departments still don't even have written policies on how to do a lineup.
Even though there's now a law in Virginia saying that all police departments in the state are supposed to have
those policies? Virginia is one of the few states that has any kind of law on this. Virginia doesn't actually require that police have good lineup policies. And we have very clear information from social science research on what a good lineup policy looks like. It's easy to do a lineup right. It's not expensive to do a lineup right. It's totally straightforward. And in fact, in Virginia, we have a really clear model policy that comes from state law enforcement, from the Department of Criminal Justice Services. In Virginia, we now have really probably the best model policy in the country for how to do lineups right. But most police departments haven't adopted it yet. And there are, not most departments, but about a third of the departments in Virginia still have no written policy at all for how to do lineups. There was a national survey done showing that around the country, far more police departments just don't have anything in writing. And you think, that's bizarre. Police have patrol manuals. They have all kinds of detailed rules on where to store their firearms, what to do if a firearm goes off, all kinds of training on interrogations, on stopping cars, on how to do foot patrols. If nothing else, police have a lot of rules, right? It's a paramilitary model organization. They have rules for everything. Why won't they have training and rules on how to do lineups? And the answer is traditionally lineups weren't seen as important. You know, you show some pictures to the eyewitness and see if he or she can pick anyone out. But we have three decades of science showing that not only is it important, but lineups can easily go wrong. And we should kind of know that, right? We all know that it's hard to remember the faces of strangers. We start to wave to someone all the time on the street and then realize it's a stranger and not our friend. You'd think, you know, police should know that. But part of it is that if police screw up a shooting and their gun goes off, even if no one is hurt, people in the community are going to be upset right away. They could get sued if they shoot someone. Whereas if a lineup goes wrong, who's going to be held accountable? Maybe years later, someone would get freed by DNA evidence and we would realize that a lineup had gone wrong. There isn't the kind of same direct accountability as when police use force. And so lineups are treated as, well, I don't know, it's just evidence. Let the prosecutors use it if they want. It's only now that police are starting to realize just how important it is to get lineups right.
Brandon Garrett is our guest. He's a named professor at the University of Virginia Law School, a longtime specialist in civil rights law, and author of the book that is the focus of our discussion this hour, titled Convicting the Innocent. This is Virginia Insight. I'm Tom Graham. We have telephone lines open if you want to join the conversation. The number is easy to remember as 888-WMRA-TALK. One more thing I want to ask you, at least one, actually, Brandon, about lineups and eyewitness identification. The social science research that you identify in your book seems to indicate that there are especially big problems with cross-racial identifications. Tell me about that.
Yeah, so people have difficulty, far greater difficulty, recognizing the faces of strangers of another race. In fact, it's also true as to age. People have greater difficulty recognizing people of a different age group. And it works both ways across all races. I worked on a case when I was in practice where it was an African-American victim and a Caucasian defendant. And what really jumps out in the cases that I researched was how many of these eyewitness cases gone wrong were cross-racial. Almost half of the cases I looked at involved cross-racial identifications.
So a white person saying about an African-American or Hispanic suspect, that's the guy. Or right. A Hispanic victim saying about a white person, that's the culprit. And in those cases, it's even more likely that there's going to be a problem with the accuracy of the identification.
Yeah, and it was interesting. Sometimes the victims would even say, look, you know, I have a hard time with African-American faces or with Caucasian faces or whatnot. They were even somewhat conscious that this is not the kind of face that I'm usually good at picking out. But they would say, but for this one, I'm sure. And that's part of the feature of how eyewitness memory works.
One of the other things that comes up in your book of these 250 first exoneration cases that you examine, exonerations based on DNA proving that the person convicted was actually innocent, a huge percentage of these wrongful convictions were minorities.
Yeah, so 70% of these cases involved Black or Latino defendants. That's an enormous number. Now, you know, listeners, we may all know that, look, minorities get convicted disproportionate to their membership in the population in our country. And so more like, you know, a third of rape convicts and murder convicts are Black or Latino, but not 70%. 70% is an enormous number. And so a real puzzle coming out of these cases is, what is going on? Why are so many of these DNA exonerees minorities? Is it that we are more willing to convict innocent people if they are minorities? Is it the severity with which we treat crimes where it's a white victim and Black or Latino culprit? Or part of the story might be these cross-racial misidentifications where people are more likely to make mistakes identifying strangers if it's a stranger who is of a different race.
Convicting the Innocent, Where Criminal Prosecutions Go Wrong, is the title of the book. Its author, legal scholar Brandon Garrett, is our guest. Solutions to the problems Mr. Garrett sees in our prosecutorial system? Solutions will be our focus when we return in a bit more than 1 minute. The book is titled Convicting the Innocent, Where Criminal Prosecutions Go Wrong. Its author, Brandon Garrett, is our guest. There's some of the aspects of the solutions side of this discussion that you talk about in your book. It's hard for me to pick one to ask you about. Do you have a favorite that you want to go to?
Well, one sort of exemplar is, how do you fix this problem of bad lineups, not just affecting eyewitness memory, but actually causing an eyewitness to pick an innocent person and be sure they got it right. And the solution is so elegant and so easy, even easier than videotaping interrogations in a way. What it turns out, the research shows that having someone run the lineup who doesn't know which one is the suspect in a way, solves all the problems, because there's no way that they can give cues to the eyewitness. There's no way that they can unconsciously sort of linger over one of the photos. You know, in some of the cases I looked at, the administrator of the lineup, the cop, would say, you know, good job, you picked the right guy. And all of a sudden the victim would feel this wave of relief. Oh, good, I did get it. Now I'm sure. Or sometimes, you know, they would say, you know, you picked the suspect. That's great. And, you know, that guy has a long arrest record. You know, finally we're going to bring this person to justice. You know, but really just trying to reassure the eyewitness, not trying to taint their memory. But some of these victims who have spoke about it years later have said, that's what tipped me over. I really wasn't sure. But it was these comments, this supportive feedback from the police, that's what really caused me to be sure that I had picked someone, even though I now know the person was innocent. And that simply just, it can't happen.
You mentioned earlier that Virginia has a recommended model policy that most of the local police departments in the state have not adopted. Is there anything else in this model policy that you see as especially important, other than having sort of the equivalent of a scientific blind test done, that
right,
the person leading the eyewitness identification process not know who the suspect is? Anything else?
Well, it's very important that you tell the eyewitness that the suspect may or may not be present. Otherwise, they assume, why am I being brought here except to pick out the suspect? It's also important to make sure you pick pictures that look alike so that no one stands out. The model policy also says, look, you should ask that witness how sure they are, because they may say they're sure, but ask them to talk about it so there's a record of just how confident they are. Because just like in the cases I studied, by the time of a trial, an eyewitness will be sure. They will have seen the suspect multiple times in the courtroom, the defendant. One last thing, it was really important in Virginia. You know, what are we going to do? There's so many of our law enforcement agencies are small departments with maybe only a few officers. How are they supposed to do a blind lineup if they don't have a police officer to spare? And that's true across the country. Most police departments are small. Well, all you have to do, the model policy sets out a folder shuffle system. You put the half dozen pictures in folders, include a couple extra blank folders too. You shuffle them and hand them to the eyewitness. The eyewitness can open up each folder and look at the pictures without the officer being able to peer over and give any inadvertent or intentional cues. The easiest thing in the world, just get some manila folders. Turns out it's really easy to do a one-at-a-time lineup that's blind. But you know, departments simply didn't know about it before. And so hopefully more departments will look to the model and realize just how simple it is to do lineups right, because it's a way to make investigations more accurate. It's a way to cut down on eyewitnesses picking out fillers, which is what they do most of the time when they're guessing. They pick out fillers. But that hurts investigations too, because all of a sudden, you know, who's going to trust an eyewitness that's picking out fillers? You know that they can pick out innocent people because they've done it.
And I'm guessing this is obvious. I just want to make sure. Filler is somebody in the lineup, either actually physically standing there in a lineup or among those pictures, that is not a suspect and is put in there to fill out the lineup.
Right. That's what fillers are. And very few lineups, it's very rare for lineups to be done with live suspects anymore. One reason is that criminal defendants have a right to have a lawyer present after an arrest, an indictment, if they're live people. So police prefer to use photos. But it's also easier to pick photos that look like the suspect than it is to find live people that look like the suspect. So it's mostly photo lineups that are used these days.
Legal scholar Brandon Garrett, our guest, 888-WMRA-TALK, our phone number. Let's go next to Harrisonburg. Mark, thanks for joining us. Your question or comment for our guest, please.
This is Mark. My question is a little bit off subject, but it might have to do with fitting in with profiling and such, but I just wonder about the legality of these routine traffic stops that the police set up once in a while, and they have no cause to pull you over, and they make you give them your ID. I questioned the officer, and he said, yeah, yes, we can do this. So what's your opinion on that?
Well, you know, Fourth Amendment law, search and seizure law is notoriously complicated, but the Supreme Court has said that certain kinds of traffic stops like that, even though there's no individual suspicion, are allowed. And we may think that police are stopping everyone not because they're trying to find drunk drivers, but just because they're trying to stop a bunch of people and see what's going on. But those kind of traffic stops tend to be legal. One really interesting issue that may come up in Virginia, the Supreme Court decided a case this spring, Maryland versus King, where they said that people arrested for serious offenses can have their DNA taken. Even perhaps traffic offenses, we don't know what the word serious means. And so it'll be a real interesting question whether that means that a lot more DNA can be taken in the Commonwealth. We have a big DNA database already and may grow a lot bigger. Now, maybe that big DNA database will occasionally free innocent people like Earl Washington, but there are also real privacy implications of having a DNA data bank that's already big and may become truly enormous.
Mark, thanks so much for your call. Brandon Garrett's book is titled Convicting the Innocent. He's a longtime civil rights lawyer who now is also a professor of law at the University of Virginia. We've got just a couple more minutes to take calls. If you have a thought you want to share or a question for Mr. Garrett, you can reach us at 888-967-2825 or on Facebook, where we are listed as WMRA's Virginia Insight. Brandon, I'm sure that there is at least one person listening to this who is saying, this guy's a longtime civil rights lawyer. His whole focus is on getting people off. And maybe what's really going on with these tough interrogations that police have done in situations, maybe sometimes they go wrong, but they also probably put a lot of guilty people in jail who wouldn't otherwise be caught. And maybe these kinds of lineups that aren't actually perfect scientifically, they actually catch people who deserve to be in jail. How do you respond to those kinds of concerns?
Well, for one, every time an innocent person is in prison, there's a guilty person out there committing more crimes. And that happened in these cases, really serious cases, where these actual culprits were out there committing additional rapes and murders.
People who were not convicted because people like Earl Washington, who was innocent,
right,
was in jail. And the person who'd actually committed the crime that he was convicted for.
Right. He was out there. But there's a larger concern. Do these reforms really not only prevent wrongful convictions, but do they hurt the chances of the police to get guilty people or not? You figure, you know, most people who confess really did do it. But what police have described is that, look, videotaping interrogations, for example, you know, all the reforms I talk about are about producing a more accurate and complete record during a criminal investigation. And normally that helps the police, assuming they have the right guy. And so police complain all the time, prosecutors even more so, that defense lawyers raise frivolous objections where the guy says, I was badgered in the interrogation room. You know, they told me what to say. Well, if you can just roll the videotape, then you could show that actually, no, this was a highly professional interrogation. Look what the guy said. And so in plenty of cases in Virginia, you know, videotape of interrogations has been incredibly powerful and an amazing tool for the police to show that they got it right and they got a detailed confession out of someone who could actually quite readily tell us how the crime happened. And the same thing, you know, the police chief in Roanoke has long adopted lineups. A couple of many of the other big jurisdictions in Virginia have blind lineups. And folks from Roanoke were at a conference that we held at UVA on lineups this spring, and they said having these improved lineups, these blind lineups, has been a godsend because prosecutors can confidently tell the jury that, look, you may have some qualms about eyewitness evidence, but we did everything possible to make sure that these lineups were done right. We did everything to safeguard the accuracy of these lineups. Now, there's a separate question of how much this person really saw and how much they remembered. But we didn't screw anything up at the lineup, and we can tell you how careful we are when we do our lineups. They even videotaped the lineups, so you can see how certain the eyewitness was at that first time when they were asked to look at the picture in the photo array. So I think all of these reforms that I'm talking about help law enforcement almost all of the time when they have the right guy. If they don't have the right guy, though, we want these reforms in place to make sure that everyone understands that a mistake has been made.
The reforms that you're most interested in include videotaping all police interrogations, changing how lineups are done so that there is a more scientific probability that eyewitness accounts will be accurate. Anything else key in these reforms?
We also need to document statements and conversations with informants. Also important to document and have clear scientific rules and standards for how forensic evidence is presented in our courtrooms. And in general, documents from the investigation need to be given to the defense lawyers. Often the defense is kept in the dark, and judges don't order prosecutors to give much except obviously exculpatory evidence. Cases will be far more accurate if the defense actually knows what the case is and what's behind it. And criminal trials are often trials by surprise. It shouldn't be like that if we want to have a more accurate system.
Next is Stanton Lewis. Thanks for joining us on Virginia Insight. Your question or comment for legal scholar Brandon Garrett, please. Lewis, can you hear us?
Yes, I can hear you.
You're on the air.
Well, I'm talking now about a case of an improper evidence presented about a confession. And this goes back to 1976 in Westchester County, New York. My name is Lewis, and I was convicted there on a confession, so-called, where I confessed that my wife was in the antique business. She is sole owner. She operated it and purchased some property that happened to be stolen at the time without knowledge. And she was in the hospital at the time when I was arrested, and they questioned me, and they asked me if those items that were some so-called stolen were in our home and in our business. And I said, I noticed that they were, yes, the things that they claimed that were stolen. But they took that as a confession, whereas the fact that I knew that these things were in our in my wife's business and in our home were actually without knowledge that they were stolen. And they presented it in court as possessing stolen property when we had no knowledge it was stolen at the time.
You know, there's a... Your horrible story reminds me of a Virginia case of a Northern Virginia man, Walter Snyder, where the police were trying to get him to confess to a rape, and they were describing all sorts of alternative scenarios, saying, well, maybe she came on to you, and he was just outraged by all of this and said, what are you saying? Are you saying she raped me? And they said, ah. He confessed.
I think you've done a good service by getting this information. Maybe it'll improve the police investigations and the improper presentation of the case.
Lewis, we just before you go, we do need to ask what happened in that case. Were you convicted?
I was convicted. They first said I was going to get 7 years. But later on, because of my education and knowledge, I started going into the legal system, and I found out that I was not afforded any of my rights. The prosecutor was misconducting his presentation of the case, and I was reduced to where I served less than 4 months. But
thank you so much for sharing your experience with us.
Completely wrecked my life at that time.
It's certainly a sad story, but your view, Brandon Garrett, is that there are many of those out there.
Well, and again, we haven't talked much about prosecutorial misconduct. But obviously, when prosecutors conceal evidence of innocence, it can stay concealed. And so we have no idea how often that happens when there's evidence that the defense never learns about. Often years later, when some of these DNA exonerees brought civil rights cases, in a civil case, they actually get discovery and get access to all the police files and the prosecutor's files. And when they see those full files, all of a sudden it's incredible the kinds of information that no one had ever known about, that eyewitnesses actually described the police telling them who to pick out or were hypnotized. In Earl Washington's case, his civil rights lawyers found for the first time that the forensics in his case had actually been altered. There was an amended forensic report, but the first forensic report actually showed that he was really clearly excluded by the forensics in a way that his defense lawyers didn't realize. All sorts of surprises come out when you get the complete files.
So we've got about 30 seconds left. Anybody who's been listening to this who thinks changes need to be made, what is it you'd like them to do?
Well, we really need to have a more accurate criminal justice system, and we can do that by having clear rules in place for documenting evidence. But we also need to change the incentives. We need to reward police and prosecutors for correcting mistakes before it results in a conviction. They shouldn't just be rewarded for headcounts. And hopefully our attitude towards criminal justice will change a little bit, where we're not just focused on incarceration, but really on getting it right.
Our guest has been Brandon Garrett, civil rights attorney, the Morgan Professor of Law at the University of Virginia, and author of the book Convicting the Innocent. Brandon, thank you so very much for your time.
Oh, thanks for having me. This was wonderful.
Virginia Insight's executive producer is Matt Bingay. Our associate producers, Bob Levicky and Terry Ward. We had extra help today from Sarah McConnell, Elliot Majerzik, and Andrew Windham at the Virginia Foundation for the Humanities. Some of our break music supplied by Robert Jaspe and Inner Rhythm. You can find audio postings of Virginia Insight by going online to WMRA.org, then clicking on programs, and then clicking on Virginia Insight. And when you go to that page, you will find links to more information about the work that Mr. Garrett is doing. Thanks so much for tuning in for this edition. I'm Tom Graham. Hope we can get together again soon for more insight.